The next and final matter on our oral calendar for this morning is trusteeship created by the Port Authority of St. Paul. It looks like there will only be one of council for each side. When you do begin your comments, give us your name and the party you represent so that we've got that for our recording. 15 minutes for appellant, 15 minutes for respondent, and 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. Whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. John Orenstein of Green Espel for CCV1 LLC and WHTW LLC. Let me start with a little factual background. 19 years ago, the owners of property at 4th Street in downtown St. Paul sold it to the St. Paul Port Authority for the construction of the Capital City Plaza parking ramp. As part of that transaction, the port entered into two contracts. One, an option to purchase and right of first refusal with WHTW. The other, a promissory note that the port gave to CCV. And there were other agreements, but those are the ones that are the subject of this appeal. Each of those contracts contains rights that the holder gets upon a subsequent disposition of the property or a proposed subsequent disposition that meets the contract terms, and the contract terms of each are a little different. Now, 19 years later, I should say in between, there were bonds issued for the construction of the ramp and those defaulted. That was several years ago. Now, the bond trustee proposes a disposition and wants the court to hold as a matter of law on the pleadings and on the exhibits to those pleadings alone, together with the contract that we put in, wants the court to hold that the contract terms that trigger my client's rights are not met. To put a finer point on it, it really isn't just pleadings. It's a verified pleading. So what we really have is the testimony of the trust officer, the documents the trustee has chosen to put in, and our CCV agreement. And what we're saying is this. This is about contracts and their application to a set of facts. And in that scenario, you need to know what the whole set of facts is, not just what the petitioner wants to produce, not just what one party testifies the facts are. And the way you get those facts is by discovery. This was an order on what was brought as a Rule 12 motion, a motion on the pleadings, pre-discovery. It was turned into a summary judgment motion, pre-discovery. And we all agree, I guess now, the parties anyway, that the summary judgment motion conversion was improper. So let's look at it as a Rule 12 motion and ask ourselves, does it appear to a certainty that my clients could prove no set of facts in support of the position that the proposed transaction triggers our rights? So let me get right to the fact issues. There's an option and right of first refusal, and here's what it says. It says that the right is triggered if the Port Authority receives a bona fide offer from an unrelated third party to purchase the property, which the Port Authority intends to accept or does accept. There's a little more, but that's all that's relevant here. And what do we know? We know from the pleading that Jet Park made an offer on October 10th, 2017. Did it make that offer to the Port Authority? The pleading says it made it to the trustee. Did it also make it to the Port Authority? The answer is, I don't know.
Well, if there's a deed in lieu of foreclosure before the disposition to Jet Park, doesn't the intention to accept or the acceptance have to be that of the trustee?
Well, I think we have to flash back to October of 2017 to answer that, because what the petition says is that it didn't happen quite the way you're suggesting, Your Honor. There was a normal listing process. The process had a listing agent. I'm pretty confident, again, without having access to all the facts, that the property was listed by the owner and the trustee, the owner being the port.
I think that's probably true.
Sure. So when the offer was made, it had to have been made to the owner and the trustee and accepted by the owner and the trustee. How it was papered 3 months later, we know how it was papered, but let's just suppose it happened this way. Let's suppose that the offer is made on October 10th. And October 11th, there's a meeting among the trustee, the Port Authority, and Jet Park, and the trustee and the port say, great, we accept your offer. Both of them say this. We accept. We want to do this. But there's a problem. If we just accept your offer and go forward as a straight-up sale, it could trigger WHTW's rights. It could trigger CCV's rights. So we're going to have to do it with this deed in lieu and assignment structure that gets you to the same place. And Jet Park says, we don't care. We offered to buy the property. As long as what we get is the substance of that, we're fine. I can't believe that if we can show facts like that, a court is going to say, nope, the form of the transaction governs. None of these facts are relevant to what the substance of the transaction really is. And all I want is the right to develop these facts and make the case, which I think is the case, that the substance of the transaction on October 10th was the purchase of the property from the Port Authority, and it was papered differently just as a matter of form. Now, the court below said, I think, three times in its opinion, oh, this is just, I don't mean to characterize it disparagingly, they said, this is the trustee wanting to do this in lieu of foreclosure. And I submit to the court, that itself is a factual issue. Is that why the trustee did this? Is that what the trustee wanted to do? After years of letting the property sit there with the trustee's right to foreclose, did it suddenly develop an intent to foreclose and do this deed in lieu of foreclosure in lieu of that intent? Or, as we suspect, was there, just as the petition says, a listing agent, a sale process, a purchaser, an offer, and an agreement to sell? If the agreements in front of you that are dated January 2019 are an outgrowth of that offer and acceptance of a sale and a purchase, I think that we should have the opportunity to show that and to make the argument on a regular summary judgment motion before a court that the court, it's a trust instruction proceeding, the court sits as a court of equity, that the court, taking all the facts into account, can hold either that these trigger our rights or they don't. But this was a rush to judgment. I don't know why, but that's what it was.
What does the trustee gain by doing it this way, by structuring it this way?
Well, one of the things it gains is that I think the trustee believes that the rights under the option and the note are not triggered.
Right. And
I suppose one could ask, well, what does that do for the trustee?
That's what I'm asking.
Okay.
And I don't understand, so
yeah.
I apologize if it's too big of a question for this hearing, but that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Okay.
Why does the other side not want these rights triggered?
Right. I think it's fair to say that the buyer, Jet Park, does not want to assume our note. So there's that. You're trying to sell it to Jet Park, and you have to say, but you have to assume this $1.5 million note. You may never have to pay it, but then again, you might. So there's that. Then there's the option. The option at least creates the risk that the transaction with Jet Park will never go forward.
But there'd be another buyer.
Right.
Okay.
Right, namely the exerciser of the option.
Okay.
So that is a little obscure to me. One thing I said in the court below was, I don't understand why they don't just grant us our option, especially if they think we can't do it. Just go ahead. Well, you have to have a public hearing. Maybe that's part of it. The option agreement says there's a public hearing. Then there's a notice that goes to us with the offer. And maybe for some reason those steps are not attractive to the trustee.
Okay.
Anyway, search me. And no doubt there will be some more process and more delay if we have to go forward in the court below, but I guess I feel that's a problem of the trustee's own making. We are here quite some time after the petition was filed, we could have been done with this already. And perhaps I'd be here on an appeal of a summary judgment motion, but perhaps not. Now, we've really gotten to the heart of what I want to say. I could say in 100 or maybe 10 different ways that there are fact issues, but that's the gist of this. There are fact issues. I could argue that the failure to give us our rights under Rule 56 upon the conversion, that that alone justifies or even calls for remanding the case. After I cited the Dolphy case, Judge Larkin was appointed to this panel, and I believe it's Judge Larkin's case. It really, though, amounts to the issue I'm saying. If you have legitimate discovery you want to pursue, it should be remanded so that you can pursue it. Even the deed in lieu of foreclosure under certain factual circumstances, I submit, can be considered a sale. It is a transfer of property for consideration. The deed in lieu agreement clearly says that the Port Authority gets consideration for it. So is that a sale that triggers the CCV agreement? Well, I think it depends in part on fundamentally how did the parties back then think that these agreements would function in a distress scenario, which is what this is. Unless the court has questions, I'll save my further remarks for rebuttal.
It appears we have none, and you will have 5 minutes on
Thank
rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Sherman, Dorsey & Whitney, on behalf of respondent Wells Fargo Bank National Association as trustee. I'll begin my argument by taking on the question that is troubling Judge Larkin, which is what benefit does the trustee see in structuring the transaction the way it's been structured? What the trustee explained to Judge Dickstein and what's still true is that the benefit of this structure is that the trustee locks in a buyer and a price and thereby mitigates the uncertainties that would attend an auction on the courthouse steps if there were a foreclosure. One of those contingencies, if there were a foreclosure, would be, would the trustee have any obligation on behalf of the holders to credit bid, to bid in the debt secured by the indenture and perhaps to acquire the facility? Well, Your Honors, Wells Fargo is a bank. It's not in the business of owning parking garages, of operating parking garages. The way the transaction has been structured is one that mitigates the risks to the holders with respect to price, with respect to identifying a certain buyer who will be able to run the ramp, and that thereby maximizes the recovery on what is a deal in default for those holders. Another point I want to make is that the questions presented, it's important to understand the context in which these issues came before the district court. This was a trust instruction proceeding. The trustee brought the petition. It was the master of the petition. It framed the issues to be decided by the district court. And what the trustee did is it said, here, Judge, are the deed in lieu agreement and the assignment agreement. Here are the first refusal agreement and the subordinated note. Interpret these contracts and tell us if they conflict. And by conflict, I mean that they activate some right either by either of the objectors. And what Judge Dickstein did was appropriately interpreted the contracts, held them unambiguous, and decided that as a matter of that unambiguous interpretation, they did not conflict. That is a class.
Sure. You agree that it was improper to make it a Rule 56?
I do, Your Honor.
It should have
it was unnecessary.
Unnecessary, and you argue that there aren't facts, that it was proper to for the judge to say Rule 12 applies and dismiss the case?
Yes, Your Honor, because there were no material facts. There were no material facts in dispute because the court looked at the all four agreements and held them unambiguous. And so any evidence that might be developed in discovery is extrinsic to those contracts and would have to be excluded. And that was certainly a proper Rule 12C ruling. And to get into the merits.
Your argument is that the district court's decision is purely a legal one.
That's correct.
There are no facts that could be revealed in discovery that would change the way you look at these documents.
That is the trustee's position, yes, Your Honor.
The way this is structured legally, it's not a sale to a third party, so we don't have to explore what went on to get us here. This is the way we've structured it, so we avoid the option to purchase.
Correct, Your Honor. The petition did not call for the court to speculate about other offers that may have been made or may not have been made other than the one that merged into the agreements that the trustee placed before the court. And that was an offer from Jet Park to the trustee to acquire the trustee's right to accept a deed in lieu of foreclosure. And to address the correctness of Judge Dickstein's reading of the contracts, first with respect to the deed in lieu, with respect to the first refusal agreement, you have two clauses that have to be read together to make sense of them both. The first is Section 4A that talks about a bona fide offer to purchase made to the authority that the authority accepts or intends to accept. And number one, that part of the agreement is important because that puts the authority in the driver's seat. If the authority does not intend to accept the offer, it's not one that triggers the first refusal right. And it doesn't have to go through the processes of involving its board and calling a properly noticed public hearing and all the rest. If, now let's just say, for instance, the deed in lieu, the delivery of a deed in lieu foreclosure was supposed to somehow be an offer from the trustee to the authority. Let me back up. The offer from the trustee to the authority to take a deed in lieu of foreclosure were somehow to trigger the first refusal right. Well, that doesn't make any sense because if you go to Section 17B2 of the agreement, you find that the trustee's rights as mortgagee are superior to, and WHTW's rights are subordinate to, the rights under the mortgage. So you can't have one event, it doesn't make any sense to have an event that triggers the first refusal right if you have another clause where it says that the deed in lieu extinguishes the first refusal right. If a deed in lieu was supposed to trigger the first refusal right, that would result in performance and the contract would be performed and be over. You wouldn't need a separate clause in the agreement to say that a deed in lieu of foreclosure extinguishes the right of first refusal. On the interpretation of the clause, what we've called the pay or assume clause in the subordinated note, we don't have here a sale or a contemplated sale by the authority of the ramp. The authority's delivering a deed in lieu of foreclosure. It's an alternative to a situation where the authority would not sell the ramp. The Ramsey County Sheriff would sell the ramp on the courthouse steps. And it's important to remember the nature of these bonds. These bonds do not give rise to a personal obligation of the Port Authority to pay. They're a special and limited obligation payable from what the indenture calls gross receipts from the operation of the ramp. So when the authority delivers a deed in lieu of foreclosure, it is not thereby acquiring any extinguishment of personal debt. If you go out and buy a house tomorrow, you would sign a promissory note and a mortgage. If the enforcement of against the collateral secured by the mortgage left a deficiency, you would be personally liable for the deficiency. Not so here. The language of the note clearly contemplates that if the authority sells the ramp, it's not going to be in a default situation. The clause of the note doesn't anticipate a default situation because what it says, the first thing that's supposed to happen after a sale of the ramp is The funds will be used to fully prepay or discharge the senior bonds. That's not happening here. The senior bonds are going to take a partial loss, the subordinate bonds a total loss. This is not a sale of the ramp by the authority, where the authority is taking a price. The authority's not getting a price. It's giving up the ramp, but in exchange, it's not getting rid of any debt that is personal to the Port Authority. Therefore, the rights under the subordinated note are not triggered. And unless there are any questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
It appears we have none. Thank you. Mr. Ornstein, you have 5 minutes if you'd like it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I agree that the trustee was the master of its petition. So here's what the petition says in the request for relief at paragraph C. The trustee wants the court to confirm that the disposition of the facility pursuant to these agreements does not result in any obligation on the part of the trustee or anybody else to WHTW pursuant to the first refusal agreement. It doesn't seem to be limited in any way. It's not limited to some sort of conflict. It goes on, or that it has no obligation pursuant to the provisions of the subordinated notes to pay in full the notes or to cause the purchaser to assume the obligations. Again, there's no limitation there. The very thing the trustee asked for is some confirmation that this transaction as proposed doesn't trigger our rights. And that's the thing we want discovery on, because there are relevant facts. I hear a lot of context from the trustee. This is what the trustee had in mind. This is what the trustee wanted to do. This is all factual material. And for the first time, I hear that the note has some provision that suggests that no distress scenario was contemplated. That's, I guess, an argument, but it's not the end of the story when you look at the note. It says, yes, that the bondholders get paid first, and then CCV gets excess cash. But if there is no excess cash, the note gets assumed. And at the very least, I think counsel's argument for the trustee raises an ambiguity about just what in the world was meant to happen here. But at best, I think what it says is, if the substance of the transaction is a sale by the Port Authority and we don't get paid, then the note gets assumed. But we still don't know what the substance of the transaction really is. The essence of the trustee's argument is that, yes, you are stuck with the form. You do have to only go by the form. That's just not so in a court of equity. And I heard reference to the offer and the offer that is before the court. Well, the offer is not before the court. That's part of our point. These documents were the outgrowth of an offer that nobody has seen except the trustee and Jet Park and, I suppose, the Port Authority. But we haven't, the court hasn't, and it can't be that a decision can be made about these valuable rights without actually looking at the offer that these agreements essentially document. There are four agreements. But two of the agreements, the deed in lieu and the assignment agreement, are themselves part of a factual scenario that needs to be understood. And that's the scenario we want reasonable discovery about. Unless there are questions, I am ready to conclude.
Let me think how to frame them. So you're not necessarily arguing that the trustee can't structure it this way. They can do this. Your argument is, should we or should the Court of Equity view this as an end run around a third-party sale that would trigger certain rights?
I'm hesitating a little over the phrase end run because...
let's use different language. Are you arguing that, okay, yes, they can do this.
Yes.
It's a different form, but in reality it's the same as a third-party sale.
That is what we're arguing. That because these documents, these January agreements, are effectuating an agreement that occurred when the offer was accepted, then you have to know what that offer was that was accepted before you know what the substance of this really is. I guess that's the most precise way I can say it. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank both of counsel for your briefing and argument. We will issue our decision within 90 days. That was the last of the four oral matters on this morning, and so we will be in recess.
Happy Constitution Day.
Thank you.
Were you here earlier?
Yes.
We recognize that. Thank you.